Hello. Such a pleasure to have you here today, Dr. Stephen Downs. Would you mind telling us a little bit? Oh,
Not
sorry.
a doctor.
Not a doctor.
Not a doctor.
I'm so sorry. I read somewhere that you were.
That's
Maybe that
fine.
was.
No, it comes up a lot, but nope.
Professor?
Not even a professor.
Stephen Downs, that is.
Just Stephen Downs, that's it.
Mr.
No
Stephen Downs.
titles.
Mr. Stephen Downs, thank you so much for meeting with us here today. Please tell us a little bit about who you are and what your relation is to the MOOC industry.
Sure. Well, I'm not a doctor, not a professor.
Okay.
So I work with the National Research Council of Canada and have for almost 25 years. And before that, I did teach at colleges and universities here in Canada. And I do have degrees, just not a terminal doctorate. I'm what they call all but dissertation or ABD. Long story. So my history with respect to MOOCs is that back in 2008, George Siemens and I created what is widely regarded to be the first MOOC. And what we did is we took together the concept of connectivism, which is basically the idea of learning networks, and we wanted to illustrate what that principle looked like in practice. So we organized a course around connectivist principles, and quite by accident, we attracted about 2,200 people to it. And one of the strengths of connectivism was that it was not a problem. We could easily handle that many people because the whole idea of connectivism is the course is a distributed network of connections among people.
Thank you so much. So a little bit more on the connectivism course that you're talking about. So from its creation, it was always intended to be open. That wasn't an
Oh, yes.
afterthought. Okay. And why was it important to you? Was it a gap that you were trying to fill of a lack of accessible education? Was it more of an experiment? Let's see if this picks up. What was your motivation?
So I've been interested in access to education for a very long time, long before my work with MOOCs, even before my work with online learning. I mean, back when I was a tutor with Assiniboine Community College, I set up a bulletin board service called Athabasca BBS in order to try to create a different route for people to access learning. I used to write about it in the student newspaper when I was an undergraduate at the University of Calgary. Access has always been important to me for a variety of reasons. We could talk about that if necessary. And part of access is open educational resources, which I began writing about in 1999, 2000. And open courses, which is what we developed with the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge MOOC. The other part of it is networks, and networks comes out of my philosophical interest, just trying to understand how people learn, how they infer, how they discover, how they're creative, how they do anything at all. And early in my philosophical career, I rejected as completely, well, wrong the brain writing theory, or more formally, the physical symbol system hypothesis, and followed what at the time was called connectionism, which was a theory of artificial intelligence, based on neural networks, where neural networks, properly so called, were computer systems designed to emulate what people thought was how the brain actually worked. And it's what I think the brain actually works. And one of the things that I've come to realize over time, And I actually did this in a paper a number of years before the first course called Principles of Distributed Representation, is that networks require openness. They require some other things as well. Autonomy on the part of the individual members of the network, diversity among the members of the network, otherwise they have nothing to talk about, right? And interactivity, the idea that knowledge doesn't originate from a single source and emanate outward, but rather it emerges from the patterns of connectivity in the network. So good functioning for networks requires open education. And so that leads to the idea of connectivism, as opposed to connectionism, as a pedagogical principle, which was taken up by George Siemens. He did a conference on it. Then we did the course to actually illustrate the principles. To me, the success of the course vindicated in to some degree the ideas in the theory.
So it was from a starting point of, okay, education should be open, diverse, interactive. It does not necessarily being represented. Let's do that. So what response were you expecting? Were you expecting it to obviously prove your theory, or were you expecting it to be part of the research?
More the latter.
Okay.
I like to tell people, not inaccurately, that we were expecting maybe 22 people.
Okay.
You
Sort of the size of
know,
a
because
classroom, I guess.
yeah, it's a pretty niche topic, right? And and we were offering like a full, I forget how many weeks it was, but 8, 10 weeks, whatever, course on the topic. I mean, who's going to spend that kind of time, right, and make that kind of investment? But it was open, but it was distributed. It was very easy for people to access because of those properties. And because of the way it was structured, it was able to accommodate that many people. And so, it was quite the surprise, but a good one.
Were you involved in the production of any other MOOCs after this one?
Oh yeah, I did a number of them. I forget how many altogether, but I did. Well, we offered connectivism and connective knowledge 4 times overall. We did one called Personal Learning, Environments, Networks, and Knowledge, or PLANK. That was pretty popular. We did a very long one called Change. That was like a 30-week marathon. That was a really interesting one. I did one on my own called Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care, which was also kind of a long one, but was for me a really important developmental exercise in that aspect of learning and technology. Did one in French on open educational resources. It's called Ressources Éducatives Libres, REL. I think it was REL 2010 or something like that. And some more. George also offered some on his own. He offered Learning and Analytic Knowledge, LAK, which he eventually translated into a whole institute, actually. Society for, I forget, SOLAR. I think it's something like Society for Open Learning and Research, something like that.
And were these all
Society.
sorry, independently started? Were they who were, did they require funding? Were they through a university?
Oh, well, that was the other factors. Like, we had no money. The original connectivism and connective knowledge course was tied to a course that George was teaching at the University of Manitoba. So he had the institutional backing, and there were 22 people give or take, I forget how many there were, from that course who actually signed up and even paid tuition to the University of Manitoba to be participant in that course. But I left that part completely to George. I had zero interest in marking stuff. I've done enough of that over the years. The others, I think his learning and analytic knowledge might have been tied to an institution. I'm not sure. None of mine were, well, except the REL course, the French one, which was offered jointly with the University de Moncton and the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie, or just commonly known as the Francophonie. It's kind of like the French equivalent of the Commonwealth.
So as well as being less, there being less bureaucratic boundaries, I guess you could say, was it also easier financially to teach in this way?
Hard to say. I mean, and the reason why it's hard to say is because there is free technology out there. I mean, Moodle existed at the time. We even used Moodle in the first couple of versions of Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. But at the same time, we used software that I authored as well. And authoring your own software makes things a lot cheaper. Although it does consume time, but so but on the other hand, there's no way we could have afforded to support 2,200 people with a traditional learning management system, open or otherwise, right? That's where the costs begin to scale up, and I think they found that with the American MOOCs, like the artificial intelligence MOOC and others that came out of places like Stanford, where they were doing it traditionally in a traditional way, but they were running up fairly large hosting costs as a consequence.
So with the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge course, what did that the 22,000 participants, did they all do it at the same time? Was there a set start date, or was it flexible with when you could do it?
Yeah, 2,200 people. And that's one of the things we said made it a course rather than just an open online resource, right? We had a start date, we had an end date. So the very fact that it had a start and an end made it a course.
Of
And
course.
then each week we had scheduled events. A pattern we fell into very quickly was the pattern of having video events that people could watch or even attend. Again, we can't have 2,200 people in a live video event like this Zoom call.
Of course.
So the video events were recorded and put on YouTube so that people could follow along that way. Also free. Because, who can afford to pay for a video server even today? We had this progression. But what I used to tell people is that the model that we're after here isn't a course properly so-called, with learning objectives and all of that, because we had no learning objectives. We had a series of topics we were going to quote unquote cover or talk about, but it was up to the participants to get out of it what they wanted to get out of it. Dave Cornier, who was along with us for the ride and actually was one of the people who coined the term MOOC, said, that you are responsible for your own assessment. You decide what you want to gain out of the course. You decide how you will evaluate that. It wasn't a course properly so called in that way. Rather, it was similar to back in the old Cambridge and Oxford days where the students organized their own education. Like each student would have their own mentor, but then the students themselves would organize their own learning, and they would, through one method or another, convince one of the professors to offer what they called a course of lectures on a given topic, right? Where a course would be a series of lectures, and the word course meant nothing more than the word series in that case, on a related topic. So that's kind of the way that we looked at it as well.
Okay, and was there any, so it was sort of self-evaluated, I guess you could say. Was there any, sorry, you want to add to that?
No,
No.
go ahead.
Was there any interaction between participants, or was it just a case of
Oh,
making your
yeah.
way through? Oh, there was.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We like to, well, me more than George, but like to term the organization as a community of communities. And so we encouraged people, encouraged a bunch of things. First of all, we encouraged them to set up their own communities and discuss the course anywhere they wanted. And so there were two in our first MOOC, there were two separate Second Life groups. There was a discussion group on, I forget what the bulletin board or the discussion platform was, but there was a discussion group. There were various other informal groups. There were in-person groups where people would meet among themselves. So that happened. But we also encouraged people to create their own blog or anything online, but especially their own blog, so that they could make comments in the blog on the course. And then what we did, and this is the software that I wrote, we aggregated the RSS feed from all of the different blogs. There were like 70 some odd blogs that were created for the course, and aggregated them, assembled them into a newsletter, and then sent it out to all of the participants in the course. So, yeah. And so, very easy to manage, right? A basic technology. People are doing their own blogs. We also aggregated the contents from some of the boards. It wasn't possible, and still isn't really possible, to aggregate from social networks like Twitter or things like that, but there were Twitter groups set up as well. And there the organization would be in the form of a hashtag, right? Hashtag CCK08. So that was a whole community as well. So, community of communities, but we tried to pull together what was happening every day and put it out as a newsletter. And you can sort of see the network structure of all of that happening, right? And importantly, the communication between people, they're all in separate places. They're not all in one learning management system. They're not all 2,200 of them in one single discussion thread. You just picture the introduction, and I've seen subsequently people do MOOCs and try to use a learning management system, and they begin with an introduction thread, and like, 2 years later, you're done reading the
Of
introductions.
course, of course. I remember doing, I did a MOOC a couple of years ago, on refugee law, and the way they structured it was you could see how many, I think it was over 1,000 people were doing it at the same time, but they would split you into, I think it was like groups of eight even, which again in real life you would never have enough rooms to create that many
You
groups.
would never have enough rooms. That raises its own problems. It's a tricky thing when you have open enrollment to split people off into groups, because what if you're in, like participation in these is really uneven. So you could end up in a group of eight really active people,
Of course.
or you could end up in a group where you're the one person in the group who's active, and so basically you're on your own. So it's really, really tough to do.
Of
I'm
course.
not sure what your experience was, but it's a practical problem.
I think what helped for me is, first of all, it was very, very international. So I don't know if they did it on purpose, but all 8 people in my group from different countries. And what helped was you're sort of giving each other feedback on work, but that's not your final grade. So if you ended up with less active people, it didn't actually affect your grade in any way. It was just a way to enhance the experience. So, okay, so that was sort of our past section, if you will. Moving on to a little bit more further down the line on our timeline. You mentioned when I first met you that MOOCs sort of had a peak time. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? When would you say in your experience that MOOCs peaked, and where did they head after that? What's your opinion on? Because there are lots of varied statistics. A lot of people say there was a peak sort of like maybe 2010s, 2013, 14, and then there's been a gradual decline. Others say that COVID saw a spike and it stayed up. Obviously, there's so many MOOC providers that it's hard to gather exact statistics. So less statistical, but more opinion-based, what would your observation be in terms of peaks and troughs?
And there's two separate types of trend to watch. The one trend is the publicity trend, the other trend is the usage trend. So when I talk about when I mentioned that MOOCs peaked, I would have picked the year 2012 as the peak. It's a year after the artificial intelligence course. It was declared the year of the MOOC, right? That's kind of like a pretty good indication that that's a peak. But that's a publicity peak. And that's a time when, especially in the US, but not only in the US, there were commercial startups that picked up on this concept and ran with it. So we have Coursera, we have Udacity, we have the one that came out of Harvard and MIT. I've forgotten the name of it.
It's not edX, is it?
EdX, thank you. That's it. We have OpenLearn that came out of the Open University. And some others as well. There were some big ones from China, which obviously were less commercial. But that's, so we had these. And then for these commercial MOOCs especially, they were up for a while, and then there was a long gradual slope of retrenchment as they tried to do whatever they could to earn back enough money to pay off the venture capitalists that funded them. And ultimately, they became more and more and more and more closed. They're still around, but I wouldn't call them MOOCs properly so called anymore, because an essential property of being a MOOC is to be open. In terms of usage or numbers, I mean, 2000 would be a peak, or not 2000, 2020 would be a peak, obviously, with the pandemic, because there were no other options. Although it's sort of weird because 2020 was more the year of Zoom than it was the year of MOOCs.
Of course.
There was a lot of this kind of stuff that we're doing, and people would offer their classes on Zoom. So they weren't really open in any sense. They were online for sure. There was a lot of open online learning that happened in 2020, again, because people had nothing else to do. So there was definitely a spike there. But, sort of roughly overall, over time, we've gone from the first MOOC of 2,200 people to now in the tens or hundreds of millions of people accessing MOOCs every day. And even more importantly, to my mind, just accessing open online learning generally every day. Those numbers are different, obviously, but open online learning is well entrenched. It's here. It's not going anywhere. There are millions of, say, videos on YouTube or how-to resources, so on and so forth. It's huge. Open online courses, as you stated, There were dozens and dozens of MOOC providers, mostly institutionally backed or government backed. It turns out there isn't really a good commercial model for offering free and open online learning. Big surprise there. That was never our intent. Technically, I suppose it might have been possible to make a company out of offering the technology, but that never really happened. The people that did commercialize always felt that the primary source of revenue would be the users because there would be so many of them. And especially if they set it up in a model where as the number of users increased, the costs would increase. I mean, for us, the real secret to a successful MOOC was that costs did not increase as the number of users increased, because in so many ways the users were self-supported. I hate using the term users, but you know what I mean. People. The number of people increased. These days we have to be careful to distinguish between people and
Yes,
users.
we do.
And this is what, this shouldn't be a surprise. The reason why so many things in society work, like cities and highway networks and telecommunications, etc., is that there isn't a centralized cost that rises and rises as the population increases. Rather, the costs are distributed across the population. And the way you do that is you give them governance and management over their own contributions. In other words, autonomy, right? And people do their own thing in their own way. In other words, diversity. And that's what distributes the costs. And that's what makes massive open online learning possible. You can't do it from a central source, really, not and have any sort of interaction. It's just a broadcast.
That's so interesting. So tell me a little bit, you said that after your initial contribution to sort of the MOOC industry and seeing that through, you moved on or integrated work on personal learning environments. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and what that means?
Well, that's a nice dovetail, because how do you make it possible for people to manage their own learning in their own way, right? You have to, I don't want to say it like this, but I'll say it like this. You have to put the tools into the hands of the people. More accurately, people have to have the tools that they need to do it, right? Transportation. You get a transportation infrastructure by giving people cars. All right. And then they decide where they're going to drive. They decide what kind of car they're going to buy, what color it'll be, etc. Sure, you can have rapid mass transit as well. But again, you don't manage it. You don't manage an entire country's bus system from a single central source. Each town has their own buses. And you do it that way. Computer networks, the same kind of thing, right? Each person has their own computer. There was a debate along over the years about what the best model was for computing, to have a big centralized processor and dumb terminals, or less centralization and smart terminals. And the internet that we've got basically has fallen onto the smart terminal side. We have fully functioning computers on our desktop or in our hands, and not things that are just simply a way of accessing a central terminal. That was a big discovery. I mean, there was a lot of argument over it, and the debate still sort of goes back and forth. You see echoes of it everywhere. So what are those tools? What do those tools look like, right? How do you move from a virtual learning environment or learning management system, a centralized kind of thing that a university would run, or a college or a school, how do you put that into the hands of a person to create a personal learning environment or personal learning management system or whatever? And that's what I was interested in thinking about. Because if you put the smart application into hands of individuals, then they can connect to other people, resources, services, deciding for themselves what they want to access and how they want to access it and for what purpose. But doing that is tricky because you can't give them a wall of code. You can't give them a desktop with 80 options to choose from. It just doesn't work like that. People won't do it for good reason. So how do you set that up? How do you help people find each other? How do you get the community part in the community of communities to work? These are all hard problems, and they're hard problems in an environment where there's no real commercial market for the product, because you can't sell something like a personal learning environment, really.
I mean, I've heard the argument that there is such a high quantity of things. There's such a high magnitude on the internet that this will lead us on actually nicely into our next segment, that people have argued that generative AI models, for example, have come about in response to that and in re to make it easier almost for people to organize what already exists online. Or maybe that was its initial purpose, and now with the addition of the generative side of it, it's actually creating new thought. So on that, a question that our followers are really, really interested in, and that I think you can help us to touch a little bit. I've written down, as a philosophical thinker, how would you say that users or people can best avoid the ethical misuse of AI on an individual level? So we have our personal learning environments in our hands at all times. AI was created for whatever purpose, but is obviously changing all the time. And it's very easy to for AI to lead to our own demise almost, is the fear. So how can we use it to support our personal learning environments as opposed to misusing it, is maybe the question.
So that sort of question is the question that I was looking at in ethics, analytics, and the duty of care. And the first part of the question, how to use AI ethically, depends a lot on what your ethics are.
Of
It
course.
depends crucially on what your ethics are. And part of my conclusion here is that there is no single commonly accepted set of ethics that governs anything, let alone the use of AI. People live by different ethical standards. It's an empirically verifiable fact. Just go out and look at the world, you see different people following different rules. I think that's good. Not because I like the idea that there's a whole bunch of people being wrong out there, but because I think that in a lot of cases, in most cases, the question of ethics hasn't been solved. We don't know what is right and what is wrong. We think we do, but we don't know. And this is especially the case with a technology like artificial intelligence, where not only do we not know what is right or what is wrong, we don't know what this technology is going to do, what the risks are, what the benefits are, what the ethical implications are in general. We don't even know whether AI will actually be intelligent or not, whether it will be capable of making its own decisions regarding ethics, and whether or not that's a good thing. So, hard question. So, where I ended up in ethics, analytics, and the duty of care was kind of twofold. The first fold is the observation that AI basically is created by and trained by us. It reflects us, especially generative AI. Other types of AI, and we'll come back to that, not a bit less so. Like a pattern detecting AI, for example, just looks for patterns. Now, what we've been training it on is our content. So it's looking for patterns in our language use, for example. But it could also look for patterns in nature. Some AIs have looked for patterns in protein cells and things like that, which have, there's no human cultural influence on the structure of protein cells. It's just a completely independent thing. But AI can find patterns in that and come up with new folding algorithms, etc. But mostly what we've trained AI on is us. And so the first fold is, if we want more ethical AI, we need to be more ethical people. So, the second part is, how do we become more ethical? And how do we even decide what is ethical? And this is where the whole network philosophy thing comes in. What we think, what any of us as an individual think is right or wrong, is based on our experiences, right? There isn't a little voice in our head that's the arbiter of right or wrong, right? There's no, philosophically, we'd say there's no a priori right or wrong. J.L. Mackey talks about inventing right and wrong, right? Is that Mackey or is that Kai Nielsen? Doesn't matter. So it's empirical, but how does that happen? Well, it's all the different influences, all the different experiences that we have, all the cultural influence. It's all of this mashed together. And so we say that our ethical beliefs are, quote unquote, emergent. They emerge from the network structure that forms. And that comes to us, if you will, as a feeling, or what Hume and Smith would call a sentiment of morality. And this, people don't like my ethical theory because, what is it for something to be right or wrong? Well, if it feels right, or if it feels wrong, right? And people go, well, that could be anything. Well, no, it's not going to be anything, right? It's going to be reasonably well determined by past experiences and personal experiences, and that's actually a really good determinant of it. If you were mauled by a dog when you were young, you would develop something like an ethical principle along the lines of dogs should be controlled. That's a hackneyed example, but it'll do, right? That's a good principle because it prevents future people from being mauled, right? So you can see that there is a rationality there, but it's not rational as in rational, properly so called.
I've just got a super quick follow-up because I'm really conscious of time.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I went on
No,
there.
that's so interesting. We've got like literally less than a minute, so I just want a yes or no from you. When you say that we as users, or when you say we can influence the ethics of AI almost or the direction it goes in, do you think that as users we have power over that, or is it in the hands of the elites that are creating it?
Yeah, that's not a yes or no question.
Sorry, of course not.
We can have control over it if we build our own AI. If we say there should be no AI, then we are saying we will have no control over the ethics of any future AI. The no AI surrenders the ethical ground.
Thank you so much.